Welcome back to another episode of Scalescape. I'm so thrilled for this one because today we have Edith Young from Raise Capital on the show. Today is a VC-focused episode and we talk about portfolio construction, capital concentration, and exit strategies. Enjoy.
I just did.
Hey, Edith. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on to the podcast. I know that you've been quite active with the local scene, you know, with Founders HK, but you're also very experienced within, you know, the whole startup ecosystem, both locally and also globally. Thank you so much for coming in on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Justin.
No, it's such a pleasure. To kick things off, can you give us a quick introduction to yourself and your experience within the startup ecosystem and how you've come to become a partner at Raise Capital?
Yeah, so just to start, I'm born and raised in Wan Chai. I grew up in Hong Kong, and I came to the U.S. when I was 16 years old. Oh, nice. I actually started my career as a developer, code, and spent 10 years mostly enterprise software, doing really, honestly, kind of boring like enterprise systems. And then after 10 years, I really wanted to learn more about consumer tech. So I quit my corporate job and Siebel, Oracle, Autodesk, and then decided to actually, I ran a conference for a couple of years, really just wanted to learn more about the startup scene. And through that, I met a lot of really interesting founders, investors. And then I joined a startup called Dolphin Browser. It's a mobile browser, mostly on the Android. Funny enough, like I met the founder through my conference. And then he was an ex-Microsoft guy. And his name is Yong Chi. And honestly, like most of my startup or investing experience is through Dolphin. We were very, very lucky and then grew from, you know, nothing to 150 million install worldwide. And then we end up sold a company to Changyo, which is a gaming company listed on NASDAQ. And then after that, I joined 500 Startups. I met the founder of 500 Startups, Dave McClure, when I was doing my conference. So that was many years ago. We became friends. And then during my time at 500, I got a little bit more active in sort of Greater China, coming back from Hong Kong.
Yeah.
I grew up in Wan Chai, for God's sake. I really wanted to, you know, do more to support this Hong Kong startup ecosystem. And then fast forward all these years later, I have a new fund called Raise Capital. We're a $100 million fund. So yeah, super excited to chat with you, Justin. I think we need more of like folks like you to, you know, really just help out the startup ecosystem.
Yeah, and that brings us to the topic for today. Right, because right now I understand that Raise Capital is still, you know, you're still actively looking to invest, correct? And I also saw that Founders HK recently had the accelerator program, the 8-week one, the free program. So that's really amazing to see the kind of impact that you have on the ecosystem. Right now, though, for the topic today, to anchor our discussion, can you give us an introduction to Raise Capital's investment thesis? And also, you know, how, you know, what kind of companies or founders that you're looking for?
Yeah, great question. So we have a very, very awesome website, and it's just sort of a little bit by accident. First off, very, very difficult to find a domain name that work. And it just happened that the few of us all love to drive cars. So all about driving. But in all seriousness, we think that, you know, building companies is not just a race. It's really, it's many, many, many races. Our fund thesis, we're a $100 million fund, really focus on seed, pre-seed, up to A, all things sort of like software infrastructure. So what that means is we don't do, never say never. We very, very focus on things that is more enterprise, developers tools, open source. There's three themes that we've been super excited about. Data infrastructure. We're actually making an announcement, one of our investments around encrypted data analytics tomorrow. Communicate infrastructure. I did an investment called Agora.io that went public last year. So it's all about like video, like Zoom as a service, essentially, if you think about it. Not just like as tools, but embedded capability of like voice or video infrastructure. And then we are pretty big on like fintech, particular in sort of like a blockchain crypto that we look at more fintech infrastructure. It's been super fascinating to sort of learn all about decentralized finance. There's a lot of activities going on in Asia, of course, in Silicon Valley as well. So primarily, I would say still 80% of our investment is very US-centric. Although, thanks to COVID, everybody literally are everywhere. I think it's a really, really great time for like Hong Kong founders or Asia founders to also sort of, you know, be able to reach out to international investors as well.
Yeah, 100%. I did see the paper that one of your partners wrote on DeFi, and that was a very good article. Back to the topic of VC though, how do you think about constructing your portfolio, right? And how would you balance between, you know, sort of a vertical focus within the specific themes that you have, but then also in terms of diversification?
Yeah, this is a really awesome question, but it have a lot to do with if you are an investor setting up your own fund today. It's a combination of you, a combination of your team, your target, your reach. So this is how I would think about it. Just to start with, if you are thinking about starting your own fund, your size of sort of your portfolio construction have a lot to do with a few elements, the size of your fund, but the size of your fund have a lot to do with the size of the round and the valuation of these companies. Most fund, at least my suggestion is to make sure that you don't have too many eggs in one basket. The ideal number of companies really should be, I would say, at least 20. But by the way, it's very, very different if you're doing late stage, right? If you're doing like a pre-IPO round or super late stage, yes, you can afford to do much less number of companies because you have very, very clear in terms of financials, revenue. Hopefully, you know, the chance of the WeWork scenario won't happen that often. Yeah. But when you get to a point where you're doing billions of dollars of revenue, I wouldn't say it's too hard to fail, but it's less, the probability is lower. Yeah. But if you're doing early stage, I would suggest at least 20 companies, if not more. For us, is we're targeting 20 to 30 companies because otherwise, it's just not enough. You just never know, particularly with early stage. Yeah. So my answer in terms of portfolio construction, when we went through ours, we're like, okay, we have very, very strong background in the enterprise space. And also we have very good track record in terms of exit, IPO and whatnot. So we know that our network is not just, because we operate in these companies before, we also have like pockets of network. And then our background of the partners, our location of the partners, and then sort of our geography, our industry. And then at the end of the day is the only thing is really about be able to execute on what you say you would do. Regardless of like what geography or stage, as long as you're confident you can make it happen, go for it. But sometimes it's just that, you know, us trying to advise founders to be focused, we as an investor should stay focused as well.
Yeah, you're right. Earlier you mentioned how you're, you know, pitching the scenario that, if you're, you know, constructing your own fund, you know, these are the things that you have. And just in my mind, I'm like, 10 years down the road, you know, when I'm starting out to, you know, raise my own fund, I definitely need to keep Edith's words in mind. So a really funny thought. The next thing, though, that you mentioned that was really interesting is that you're right. I think when we look at, you know, early stage, late stage, stage is really like a proxy word for risk. Right, there are different kind of risks that are attached for the different stage companies, and those are different elements that you need to, you know, keep in mind when you're also constructing a portfolio. My next question is to that end, right? What do you think is the right level of capital concentration into each company, and how would you sort of allocate, you know, as an investor, whether it be through follow-up checks, you know, that kind of capital concentration in one company?
Knowing what I know now, I realize, you really have to do like analyze and calculate where what makes sense. It's not about the dollar amount per company. It's really about ownership per company. And it's all math, right? That's why like when you're doing early stage, like hypothetically, you have a $100 million fund. Actually, let's say you have a $10 million fund. It's just smaller and smaller. So in my case, which is my previous scenario, was let's say I own 10%. I own 10% of a company when they originally worth $10 million. Okay. And by the way, I'm not even saying like pro rata and all that, but it's just straight math. This $10 million company valuation now become $100 million. So for me to own 10%, I can return 1x my fund. This is before fees. So, but imagine if I didn't put when 1 million, when it was 10 million, I only put $100,000. Even if it become a $100 million outcome, I don't own that much, right? So it's really about the portfolio. Back to your question about portfolio construction. If you have X dollar, you really need to ask yourself, what's my target performance for my bucket of money, whatever that is? $1 million, $500,000, or maybe like $100,000 or 50K, doesn't matter. You end up really should think about, I own this, and when it becomes this, then it's all math. And it's really that discipline. And so in some sense, I think my previous fund, we didn't own enough, but I was very, very lucky, which later on we can talk a little bit more about exit. It is so fascinating about different way of exit. But one of them have done so well. So then it basically took care of all my other ones that fail. So at the end of the day, yeah, you can kind of traditional fund also like would budget the fund to actually to maintain your ownership. So it depends on like the general partner that you talk to. Some will literally tell me our first check is 1/3 of the fund, and then for the rest of it, it's all pro rata. That's actually a lot. Yeah. Or some would say half of the fund is first check, and then everything else is for pro rata. So a lot of different funds have different school of thoughts. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I think it's really about having good discipline. So then you can consistently, again and again, be able to perform.
Yeah, for sure. And earlier you mentioned, you know, it's really about looking, because you like you said, the minimum that you'd like to invest in is like 20 to 30 companies, right? And realistically, 20 to 30 out of those 20 to 30, you know, only a very small percentage of them would be able to get you a 10x multiple or a multiple enough to be able to return, have a very good ROI to you know, carry the fund forward. So definitely right. In terms of also diversifying your basket of eggs, a very good analogy. Can you walk us through, Edith, the decision-making process when it comes to exit strategy? And for example, in which kinds of scenarios would you push, you know, for an acquisition or versus IPO? And, you know, in which stage, how do you think of that?
In the world of startup, money is not everything. And in fact, money is a commodity. What I meant is, it's not up to me how I want to exit. It's up to the CEO. I am icing on the cake. Obviously, I have opinion on the exit, but just to start, the role that I play is a sounding board rather than a driver's seat. And of course, I have better relationship with some founder CEO, but if I am the one driving, I may as well run the company. But if I didn't run the company, I may as well not invest. And I think this is a golden time in terms of exit. I think CEO, founder, DC have so many options from M&A to IPO. And if you're doing crypto stuff, there's ICO. And then if you want to get listed, there's SPAC, there's direct listing. There's so many. And is, you know, like in the old days, IPO is the holy grail, right? Like I want to be the one that actually stand, doesn't matter, like in Hong Kong Stock Exchange or New York Stock Exchange or Nasdaq, to ring the bell, right? That's the ultimate bell and holy grail you wanted to hold. Last but not least, I think M&A is one of those things where is an art and a science. In the world of M&A, there's many, many stages of M&A. Sometimes like it could be purely talent acquisition, which happened a lot in the early stage. And sometimes it's because of land grab, right? Like, oh my God, if I don't buy this company, my my competitor will buy it. Or you buy for revenue, for EBITDA. You buy it because you can expand the product. you buy because it's faster to buy than build. So you really have to kind of think from the acquire point of view, not from your point of view. And yeah, so what I want to say is when I was at 500, we have a debt vehicle that we use called KISS, Keep mm-hmm. It Simple, Stupid. Mm-hmm. And as part of that legal documents, we have a clause, which all of our founders hate. But I really don't think that they understand what that language meant. And we have a 2x liquidation preference if you sell your company before you do your equity round. So what that means is this language will automatically go away when you do your next round of equity financing.
Yeah.
So because it happened to, at least when I was at 500, it happened to us so many times. They raise, I don't know, million, 2 million, and then Google come and buy and done. Then what's the point? So at least not for investor. So we sort of instrument that language to sort of, in some sense, we are with you all the way. But if you're not with us all the way, you just wanted to, you know, sell your company quick. We actually in the past have legal languages around that, although all our founder hated it. So because there are a lot of companies or founders, there's nothing wrong, by the way. I we have definitely invested in company again. Second or third or fourth time, even though they sold it early. So in general, like at least my partners at Raise Capital and I are very founder friendly. Mm-hmm. But more or less it's because we've seen so many, we don't want to sweat the small stuff.
Yeah, 100%. Two things that you mentioned that I thought were very interesting. The first one that you said, you know, when thinking about acquisitions is thinking about from the acquirer's perspective, or, you know, rather than your perspective. And I think, you know, I was speaking to actually the co-founder of Siri just yesterday, and he was also saying a very similar thing. He was saying, you know, reverse engineering sort of like that exit and think about, you know, where this company will go from also the perspective of the acquirer and how that partnership, because essentially, you know, acquisition is also very much like a partnership. As much as, you know, the acquirer wants a land grab or a talent acquisition, it's really about coming together and making, you know, the product a lot better. So I think that's very interesting. And, you know, the second thing, the interesting thing that you said is, you know, how the relationship between investor and founder, you know, you really want to keep that, you know, you want to be aligned in vision so that, you know, there's not too much conflict. But then when that arises, you know, like you said, second chance, third chance, and letting that founder, you know, go far and go very, very big. What happens, though, if there's a conflict in exit strategy? For example, you know, the founder has a very lucrative acquisition offer, you know, very early on, but whereas it's not in your best interest as an investor, you know, to settle for such an early exit. How do you resolve such a conflict?
Yeah, so for us is with Raise, we're getting a little bit, well, at least I am. My partners are all super experienced. I mean, Alfred built billion-dollar companies and took company public before. So in that sense, like the discipline for a lot more than like later early stage. So now, like with companies that we own more than at least 15%, we usually have a board seat. Mm. So just basically making sure there's adult supervision. So a lot of the bigger VCs, if you participate or leading any sort of like Series A or B or whatever, you usually have liquidation preference, mm-hmm. And we usually have board seats. So in that sense, a lot of things that there are governance that we put in place to make sure that our right is protected. Yeah. But at the end of the day, but we want everybody to win. So by the way, I do want to add on like one more thing. As I was like preparing for this conversation, I remember I was listening to Mark Suster. Gave a talk about like M&A. Mm-hmm. Company is never... like you don't sell a company. It's like they're bought, not sold. So you can't really sell it. It's really about like your brand. Like, are you doing? Do you already have a relationship? Like, what stage are you? Or are you, like it's a lot of timing, And so like you kind of always have to think about, if you even think about it, it's not like, oh, it will just happen. It happened over years. Yeah. And at the end of the day, especially if you're early, when they buy you, they buy you. Mm. the team. So if you don't know what you're talking about, or if you are not really in, have a place in that particular vertical industry or geography, it's very, very hard to sell a company.
Yeah. That's such an interesting perspective about how, it's a company's bought, not sold. And I think it comes down, I think you're right. It comes down to over a very long period of time, because it's not like just like, oh, I have a company right now. Oh, I'm going to look out for potential acquirers. It comes down to a lot of the background, you know, sort of like relationships that you've built over the years, the different people in the ecosystem that know the kind of product that you're doing. And then, like you said, the kind of domain expertise, if you have a place, if you have skin in the game within a vertical, you know, then that is what is going to make that acquisition, you know, a lot more attractive. In what situations though, is it appropriate to exert governance, right? You know, like you were saying, it's like a parent position, but is it ever effective to, you know, when it has to come down to, you know, the board decision, when there's a conflict, how does that look like?
So I think like the best performing companies that we have are the ones where I don't actually even need to. We should probably write a post about this, because a lot of the early stage founders actually have no idea how to even host a board meeting or prepare for it, or board members dynamics, or don't even talk about board. Like a lot of them are just not even good at update. So we often have to sort of chase. But at the beginning, I think sometimes I realize I also owed it to ourselves, because we assume a lot of things, everybody, and not when you're founder CEO, is almost sort of seems like, wait, like I feel embarrassed if I don't know, but it's okay. If you're first time CEO, there's a lot of, it's okay to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
For us, I realized the best performing companies are the one that they just have really great discipline. At a minimum, if not every month, like every quarter, very, very clear updates, regular board meetings, great to communicate on your KPI, your cash flow, how much money you have left.
Yeah.
And they're usually the ones that ask for help.
Yeah.
Because it's not possible everything great. In fact, 99% of the time, like you just feel like you the boat is sinking, especially at the beginning. So, and especially I think sometimes like the whole investor founder relationship is that, like I don't want to be anybody's mom. I want to be your confidant and supporter, and we're already on the same boat. Like we should help each other to succeed. And then sometimes I think a lot of the founders are worried or scared to communicate things that's gone wrong. Mm-hmm. And I really think that we should really build a trusted relationship among investors and founders.
Yeah, 100%. It's really about tying together that kind of synergy between founder and investor. And like you said, you know, not so much a mom, but more of a confidant, where the founder is able to, you know, freely be able to speak up when there's problems, be able to freely give updates on KPIs, cash flow. So very, very important. One last question for this episode, Edith, although I think that we definitely need to have more conversations, is this. I always want to give my guest an explanation on the title of the podcast. So you must be wondering, so why is it called Scalescape? When we're scaling a company and we're building a company, we need to take into account the landscape, the bigger picture of things, the geography, product market fit, timing, what kind of waves, what kind of triggers, what kind of trends will be able to propel, you know, my company towards success. And so my question to you is this, Edith, what is one tip that you have to give to founders to scalescape their companies towards success?
There's so many.
I know, but you gotta just pick one.
I think that there's many, 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 many things, but if you want to scale, this is a little bit more personal, is you yourself need to get the hell out of the way. Because when you are a CEO, you cannot be like always do one thing. Actually, your job when you get to a certain place, at the very beginning of it, is all about the product. But once you figure out product market fit, it's all about hiring. Hiring like for a growth stage CEO should it's like almost full-time job. In fact, hiring a good recruiter is even harder, but you need to get out of the way so your people can do the work that they're great at. I think like the hardest thing for most of our early stage CEO to growth is they just feel like everybody else are not good enough. And they end up doing most of the work. But I think our education system and the way that we work in corporate, we're so good at one thing. And if you're a really great CEO, you can't be good at one thing. In fact, you should be good at nothing, because you need to hire the best people to work on product, to work on growth, or whatever. You need to get the hell out of the way if you want to grow fast. That would be the one thing I hope all founders realize and have the empathy to realize that.
For sure. It comes down to trust. Thank you so much for your time, Edith. I had such an amazing time, and we look forward to having you again on the podcast. See you soon.
Thank you for having me. Bye, Justin.